I'm talking now to Robert Thurman about his latest book, Wisdom is Bliss. And it was just released on your 80th birthday. So happy birthday, first of all.
Well, thank you, Pat. It has been a lot of fun, actually. Actually, it has to be bliss, I guess.
I guess so. There is a very, very happy feel to this book. Was this something you had meant to write for a while, or is it something that just comes out of this particular time of life?
Well, life is getting shorter now as I'm getting older. I have been meaning to write it for a while, and I'm really happy that I did, actually. And unlike some of my earlier books, I'm still liking my book. Usually I kind of wish I had rewritten something else after I publish a book. This time I really like it. I think it's great. And, you know, I feel that everybody is too hepped up and people are too angry and frustrated nowadays on all sides of every issue. And it's very important that we cheer up, I think. The subtitle of the book really should be Cheer the Heck Up.
It's almost contagious, too, all the anger that is out there or frustration. You might turn on the news and you're watching it and you're in a good mood, and all of a sudden, 15 minutes in, you're as mad as they are. So
I know that's because we do share, we being human beings and being sensitive about each other, we definitely share our vibe.
Yes.
So if we send out lots of bad vibes, then everybody else will be just as unhappy as us. So I'm trying to send out some good vibes, and I think I have a basis in reality. Just that people normally don't touch on that kind of a basis because they're sort of scared. People will say, well, gee whiz, how can reality be bliss? There's so many difficulties. And then they'll think you're just being Pollyanna or whatever. Although I don't know Pollyanna. She might be really nice.
Yes, I agree. Well, why would you say wisdom is bliss?
The slogan we have, that ignorance is bliss.
Yep.
Which comes from our being terrified and terrorized by our culture, sort of authorities, that wisdom is to be resigned to the misery because life is automatically misery. And then if we're religious, we think, well, God will make me happy later. You know, life is a veil of shadows and tears and so on. And then if we're a materialist, like an atheist or a scientist or something, we then say, well, at least when I'm gone, I won't feel anything and I won't know. I'll be in nothing. You know? So we have some sort of a consolation, but we're convinced that reality is dangerous and bad and filled with pain and suffering. So we think if we don't know, we'll be great. But my argument is that if we don't know, we're living in denial because we think reality is bad. And actually, the great teachers of humanity, like Buddha and Jesus and lots of other great figures, they taught us that ultimately reality is really good even now in life if we really are realistic. So I'm just contradicting ignorance is bliss. I'm saying wisdom is bliss.
Yeah. And you talk about aspiring to be more self-aware as you're evolving. It's an evolutionary
yes.
kind of thing. And I like that because then
yes.
it's your life's work. You're working towards something.
Exactly. That's sort of what I have been and studied a lot, the Buddha's teaching. But I don't see it as a big religious thing. I see it as a scientific and educational thing more. And his understanding of the way the life force works, a way of aligning oneself with that life force to be really happily alive. And it takes an education. It takes not just meditating either. It takes learning and unlearning all kinds of theories that we're handed by authorities in Eastern cultures as well as Western cultures who want us to feel, sort of keep us in line, you know, by saying, well, you know, you can't have everything. You can't have it all. You got to just obey orders, get to work, get that low wage, minimum wage job, and dish those burgers or whatever it is. And then later, you know, you won't get enough money for a pension. You can get some Social Security. And then later, you know, after you die, God will make you happy if you've been obedient. Yeah. And actually, that's a nice idea, at least that God would make them happy. But if that's the case, but the thing is, we can also be happy now and have meaningful life, meaningful work. And nobody else needs to push us around, you know?
Yeah.
We can be free. We can be free while alive, and we can be good while we're free. We can even be better, and we can do more creative things by being more free. That's the idea.
Well, if somebody were, let's say, a Catholic or a Jew or a Protestant, could right. they use wisdom is bliss for absolutely. More self-awareness sort of layered on top of what they're doing? You're not advocating that this is a religion that would replace another religion at all.
That's right.
I didn't get that from your book.
Oh, good. I'm so glad, Pat. No, I am glad because, you see, although because I do mention Buddha and because yes. the educational methods, psychological methods of spiritual psychology, you could say, come from the Buddha and his followers, some of his followers. But they are taught like a teaching, not just as something to believe, you know, by just yes. joining or becoming a member, so to speak. And so, therefore, in history, in many cultures, that Buddhist education method and sort of self-development method has coexisted very harmoniously with all kinds of religions and ideas. And at present day, under the inspiration of Dalai Lama, who's a good friend of mine, he gets along really well with secular, you know, materialistic scientists. But he likes to recognize that the humanism that they espouse, you know, the wish for justice and for kindness and gentleness and so forth, even though they don't do it based on a religious ethic, mm-hmm. they just have a humanistic ethic. But he thinks that's spiritual. That can be spiritual, and he gets along with that. So, yes, that's my point. And I thought that would be, it's a way of trying to help people have methods that are very time-tested and very excellent and keep their own cultural connection to their religion. And he always, Dalam always says, he wants everyone to keep their grandma's religion. Yeah. Whatever it is, keep it, but then enjoy it more. That's his goal, and that's my goal in the book. You know?
By the way, what happens when the Dalai Lama dies? Is there somebody who replaces him? Or
not right away, but it usually takes a couple of years. But they have all these committees, they do divinations, and they find someone who was born at the right time, and they find what they consider to be his reincarnation. But in the next time, he has declined to be involved in the politics of the Tibetan society. He will only want to be a spiritual teacher and a figure. He doesn't want to be involved in political decision-making and authority and so on. Although he'll be still called Dalai Lama, he's not going to be responsible for the state. Whether it's an autonomous republic within a Chinese federation, like the Russians changed to develop the Russian Federation, that's his hope, that there's an autonomous Tibetan republic within the Chinese Federation, or whether China has collapsed by being too aggressive, chaos, because of the government, the Communist Party, being too aggressive, a dictatorship. But he's not going to be political in whichever version it is.
How about the story of Chan Zen?
I used a lot of material from Zen because I think they're one of the very remarkable people, although they mainly focus on meditating, which is the name Zen comes from just meditating. Meditation is an important tool for education. You know, like when you learn French or something, you learn something, you learn and memorize the word, but then you have to repeat it many times in order to become fluent in it. And so that's like the meditation of learning French. It goes along with the learning to yes. sort of deepen the learning in your mind. But Zen has a lot, it's a great tradition in East Asia. And I quote a lot because I admire a lot of the great Zen teachers. But in a way, I don't draw much on that tradition because, as I say, they don't emphasize learning and study and mindfulness in ethics and so on, which the larger Buddhist education system is very into that. And also, they don't emphasize so much the science of psychology about how to handle your emotions, which the Buddhists in India and Tibet did really well. They really developed a very sophisticated developmental psychology. And that's what I really draw on.
You don't have to get stuck where your mind leads you. And I was sort of mulling that around today.
In other words, you by observing internally, which doesn't necessarily, it intensifies when you meditate that way, but you do it anyway, whatever else you're doing during the day, you generally and gradually cultivate more self-awareness, sort of observe the inner workings of your mind, where the sort of narrative voice that you have, you know, where you say, oh, now what should I do now? Oh, I just came into the room. Oh, I'm elderly. I forgot why I came here. Oh, right. I want to find my car key. You know, we have this kind of inner narrative. And we tend to think there's just one voice, which is our voice. And then sometimes if we get depressed or someone who has depression, which a lot of people have, right, there's so many antidepressants on the market. One of our national problems and diseases is depression, right?
Definitely.
And all those people who get addicted to the opiates and everything because they're depressed. So in other words, when you're depressed, it's because you have an inner narrative. that say, oh, everything is no good. Oh, I don't like my job. Oh, yeah. I lost my job. Oh, I'm unhappy with my sibling or my mate or mm-hmm. my parent or my child. Some kind of thing in one's mind, one is unhappy with everything. And we're telling oneself how unhappy one is. So then the inner observation of one's own inner voice, you begin to realize, well, where does that voice come from? Why am I always seeing the glass half empty instead of half full? And then suddenly, if you look at it more carefully, you realize, well, gee whiz, I have internalized. Yeah. I used to know somebody who used to tell me, oh, you can't do this, oh, that's no good, or the other. Yeah. And now I kind of tell it to myself, you know, and I've internalized that. But I have another voice where I can cheer up and I can see the glass half full. So I'm going to start reinforcing that voice and sort of changing the narrative. And of course, that's what a psychiatrist does when yes. one goes to a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. They listen to you and they say, well, are you sure that's how the only way you can interpret that event that happened and so on? And they sort of help you come to around to seeing things in a different way. But we can do that with ourselves. You know, the Indian psychologists, the Indian inner scientists, as they call them, develop a kind of yoga of how to observe your thinking. They are very systematic and good at that, that in case everybody can't afford or can't find to go to a shrink. I'm glad that that's appealed to you because it's very helpful. I always use the story of the famous spiritual teacher, Eckhart Tolle, who is not selling a particular religion either. It calls it The Power of Now. He wrote a book like that. And he tells a story about how he was talking himself into suicide. He was so depressed. And then suddenly he found another voice in his mind that said, oh, why should I listen to you? Maybe I'm not worth much, you know. Maybe life is not useless, you know. And saved his life that way, actually. And then he developed that into a whole method, which is very similar to what the kind of thing I'm teaching in this book. And to cheer people up, and he's helped a lot of people. He's really great bestseller, you know. Eckhart Tolle.
A lot of chronic pain, people get in a groove where they're talking about, oh, my aching back, oh, my God, my hips hurt, yes. oh, my God. But if they would get off that groove and stop talking about it and thinking about it, they might go a long way to getting out of that neural groove. They're absolutely. Not in pain. So
absolutely, absolutely. There's a method of where you, okay, I'm going to remember if I scratch it, it'll be worse. So I won't scratch it. There are definite methods of using the mind to reinforce a kind of tolerance and intensify one's ability to tolerate that painful knee that I have and my bad back and my bad shoulder. And actually, there's one guy I love, Anthony William. I don't know if you ever bumped into him, called Medical Medium. He wrote popular books, and I like it. He's kind of a personal friend. Not real close because he's so busy, but he always says you should talk to your body parts and like your liver and say, good morning, liver. Thank you so much for cleansing my bloodstream. Or hello, Benini. I hope you feel better today. Kind of encourage your different body parts to function more smoothly.
I like that.
Pain. I like that. I think it's very true.
If you can talk to plants, why not talk to your knee?
Right? Exactly. Although I happen to have a very stubborn left knee. But actually it talks back to me and says, well, I won't hurt so much if you take a walk today instead of sitting at your desk all day.
Start moving, you know, Thurman.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I like a portion of the book where you talk about deciding how you're going to earn a living in life because, you know, you have to pay the bills. You said you decided to make the university your monastery. What advice, if any, do you give to a young person who might come to you and say, boy, I'm trying to find my way and I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, very often young people do have some things that they like to do. They love the art class in the primary school, or they like, some people actually like math. Some people like to read stories and things. You know, so they have different aptitudes. You know, some like to act in plays and things. So the key is, but then often, if their dad was a lawyer or something and they like art, then if it's a guy, then there's pressure on them to not, that's a frivolous thing the family might think. Or if they're a girl and the mom does something and then they have some other interest. So there's often the fact of not being able to find their way has to do with peer pressure or parental pressure or even school pressure about how they should do this, they should do that. And so I think the key is people should be more reinforced to cheer up and to realize that when they are feel cheery doing something, then that is probably, say, to do something in that area. And usually people feel cheery doing nice things that other people like, and that they then get positive feedback from other people. And then they're happier because the other people are giving them positive feedback. So if they follow their bliss, as Joseph Campbell famously said, before I wrote this book about how wisdom is the bliss. But anyway, if they follow their bliss, don't forget that pole star, you know, they're aiming toward what it is they really like as they grew up, you know, and try to figure out a profession or a livelihood that will engage with it. You know, if they love people, if they like them, they might go and become a social worker or a doctor or a nurse, you know, if they like taking care of others. If they love food and they like to cook, then they'd be a great chef. Very often people choose something just because they have an idea of money, they want money, or someone, some peer who says that's what you should do, even though they don't like it. And then when they get middle-aged, they have a rebellion because they find themselves depressed doing something that they never liked to start with, midlife crisis, you know, and then they have lots of problems. The key is, I think, to trust oneself more. That's another thing. Wisdom is bliss, because wisdom means sort of evaluate yourself and decide that when something that I do makes me really happy, and if it's not overtly, like if I eat 3 pounds of sugar a day, obviously I'll be a diabetic by 12, you know.
Yeah, really.
So you know, one can also be practical. So the wisdom is, you know what you like. If you notice I like that, then you say, well, there must be a way I can make that my contribution and do it in such a way that society and others will reward me for that, meaning I'll earn a living that way. And that's the way one should seek one's livelihood. And usually we human beings, some people will maybe convince us that human beings are basically vicious. You know, there are theories like that, and I don't agree with those. And I think anybody who observes what they are as a human compares themselves to an alligator or something, that we're sort of soft-skinned, we don't have big claws, we don't have big jaws. You know, we're not basically built to be vicious. We're built to be, we like to shake hands, we like a pat on the back, and we are basically friendly and social animals, you know. So usually people will be happier when they do something that's not too violent, it's kind of gentle, it's kind of friendly, and that gives a positive response from others. Babies like it when mom smiles, baby's happy, you know? Mm-hmm. So baby smiles, you know? Mm-hmm. And so following wisdom, following one's bliss by using wisdom to really look at one's reality and don't accept some theory just because some drill sergeant sort of person like that guy in the movie Avatar said they had to go and kill all the natives because the natives were nasty. Actually, he was not correct. The natives were nice. After they won the battle, they let them all go home. So they should use critical wisdom to not accept some theory about themselves. Oh, you have to do this because you were born like there, or you're such and such a person, and you have to only do that even if you hate doing that. Then you shouldn't accept that. And when you're young enough to do something about it, you choose what you like. That's the way. Yeah. Yep. So I'm glad you like that part, because there's a lot of wisdom in the ancient Indian spiritual science, inner science, about how to have a livelihood which is useful for others and not harmful, and therefore making you happy and them happy.
Well, I think that you certainly selected the right livelihood, because you are a happy camper, or at least that's coming across.
That's great. In one way, sometimes I jokingly say I'm quite as miserable as everybody else about the climate change, you know, the global overheating. I see the terrible floods on the news. Even when we're very open and we don't try to hide from the hard things in life, and we're open to seeing it, the thing is, what we know from experience is, if we just get mad or depressed and we say, oh, it's hopeless, or get mad and we say, oh, it's so-and-so's fault, I have to go and destroy them or something. If we don't do either of those two things, whatever we do about a hard thing, we'll be more effective at it. You know, in a family, if somebody is losing their temper in the family, if the other, which is going to create a scene, right, and maybe harm, maybe a fight, But if the people, other people, they can have a little humor, maybe very often they can kind of make a joke or something or distract the person who's about to get mad. Certainly a skilled mom knows how to distract a kid
yes.
from having some tantrum mm-hmm. over they didn't have three more toys or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're skilled at that because they're not yet upset. If the kid is really stubborn, then the mom will get upset finally.
Yes.
But the more happy you are, the better you are at remedying a bad situation. So that's my message to people who are sort of tending toward extremism in either direction in our society right now, where they're very intolerant and angry at the other side. The key thing is, don't try to argue with them. Keep your view, but try to be happy without attacking anybody. And realizing that if you're more cheery, maybe you'll win out because the other one will decide, well, maybe they're cool because they're more cheery. And mm-hmm. I mean, and you have to be really cheery to be cheery effectively. If you pretend and fake it, you know, and you're really underneath seething with resentment, that will come out, you know.
<That's>
so
for sure.
So actually you have to be cheery. And therefore, it's like a strategic or tactical method in dealing with these terrible problems that we all face together as in this society, that if we're happy, we'll come up with, we'll naturally attract friends and followers, and we'll come up with positive ways of getting the vote out or voting for this side or that mm-hmm. side, and we'll be more successful at whatever it is we're trying to do. And even if what we're trying to do is maybe not so sensible because it's too extremist, when we're happy, we may be relaxed if it doesn't go exactly the way we wanted it. Because, you know, we can be more tolerant of a little compromise when we're happy. It's only when we're unhappy that we sort of feel incapable, we feel weak, and we feel we have to be mad, therefore, and we feel we can't compromise one inch. And so then we're stuck, you know. So that's even, so happiness, I argue, bliss, is actually a positive strategy as well as makes you feel better.
I love it. I love it. Anything else you want to add before we conclude?
No, except that I think we should really avoid people who make us mad, even if we agree with them. In other words, even if we're on one side or another of the big divide in the country, people should, one of the things I try to achieve in the book is encourage people just not to let themselves get mad. And even I don't agree with them, okay, but hold your view. It's your view. You're free to hold it. But hold it while you're happy. If somehow your view kind of dribbles away or gets weak when you're not angry, then there's something wrong with it. So don't look for like-minded people who make you angry. Look for like-minded people who cheer you up and who you feel cheery in their presence. And therefore, you know, there are certain people in the media, which is very powerful, talk about adopting a narrative and making it your own. If you listen to a lot of certain people in the media, whether they're right or left, but who are who sort of stir up anger, but they say, so-and-so's really bad. Ah!
Yes.
And they're very extreme in their opinion. They are profiting off making you feel unhappy. Because when you're angry, you're unhappy. So I would avoid them even if I agree with them. I would say, well, I like your show. I agree with what you say. But you know what? I already agree. So I don't need to hear you say it again in a way that makes me angry. Avoid people who make you angry. And then, of course, if your opponents make you angry just by being there, maybe you could steer clear of them too and just have a picnic with your own guys. But just don't invite the people who are going to, in the middle of the picnic, while you're chewing on your hot dog or your shake or your pizza, who are going to jump up and start shouting about how bad the other people are. Because, you know, then you're not going to digest your pizza. Say, look, okay, they're horrible, but let's have fun here. We don't have any of them right here right now. We have a pizza. My wife taught me that, by the way.
She's
not
brilliant.
Not the Dalai Lama, but she taught me that. You know what she used to do? And when we were, some in our young life, especially when I was working stressfully, you know, as a young professor or whatever,
yes.
I would come home sometimes frustrated. And I would say, well, you know what happened today? And I'm like, like that, in that kind of hot way. She would be there, and kids were there, and she would say, "Well, why don't you not tell me right now, so we don't both get upset? Keep it to yourself until so we both don't get upset, and then you cheer up, and we'll look at the evening now and what's going to happen, and then later you can tell me when you're in a better mood about it."
I like that.
You mean you don't want to hear my what I'm so annoyed about? She said, "No,
not really."
That's right. She said, "Just shut up until we're both, so we won't both be pissed off.
Let me mix you a drink, right?"
That's right. That's the type of thing. That's right. And I learned that is a great strategy. You
know, that is a great strategy.
Deflect the bad mood above all.
You are marvelous. Thank you so much for taking the time.